Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, both forms of inflammatory bowel disease. A chronic, painful inflammation that affects the lives of almost 1.5 million people in the United States. But what causes it? Who is affected? If you have it, what can you do to control your symptoms? For answers, stand by. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Inflammatory bowel disease is a disease without a cure, affecting old and young. It requires a lifetime of care. However, many treatment options make control possible. Diagnosis is the key. Meet Blair and her family as they share the journey that they're on.
Before Blair was diagnosed with Crohn's and colitis, she was probably throwing up every day, once or twice a day. She wasn't getting any nutrition into her body, and so she was wasting away and getting thin everywhere.
During the flare-ups, it's many, many times to the bathroom. A lot of it is severe cramping. There would be time for her that as the disease progressed, that she was in excruciating pain and would double over. It really was quite earth-shattering to find out that your happy, healthy child now has a life ahead of her with possible surgeries, serious medications, medications with a lot of side effects.
Most of the drugs that they have that they use to fight Crohn's are actually designed for other diseases. One of the medicines she takes is a chemotherapy drug for cancer patients. This disease is my child's immune system. It's too strong. And we gotta try and take it down a notch. Which also is a little scary because you're taking your daughter's healthy immune system, weakening it on purpose, and then you worry that she's going to get a little staph infection and have a tough time fighting that.
And you see your child in the amount of pain that they're in, she's just crying and she's like, "Mom, I hurt so bad, please make it stop," and you can't do anything. It's devastating. I can sit and worry and be frantic and say, "Oh, I hope somebody else goes out and raises some money and helps to cure Crohn's and colitis," or I can go do it myself, and it's my way of coping.
And it's important to find a way to cope. Today we have a gastroenterologist from Capital Digestive Care with us. Welcome, Dr. Genovese.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now tell us, what are the symptoms of irritable bowel, of inflammatory bowel disease?
The main symptoms tend to be abdominal pain, difficulty eating, diarrhea, rectal bleeding. Those are the four most common symptoms.
And we're talking about inflammatory bowel disease globally, but there's a difference. There's ulcerative colitis and then there's Crohn's disease. They're the two main ones, aren't they?
Yes.
What are the difference between the two?
Basically, the difference is the involvement of the intestinal tract.
So if we talk about ulcerative colitis first.
Ulcerative colitis involves only the large intestine or colon.
Which we see an image of there. That's just the large bowel. And then what about Crohn's disease?
Crohn's disease commonly affects the small intestine, but it can affect the stomach and the swallowing tube almost anywhere in the digestive tract.
So anywhere from top to bottom is Crohn's disease. So that's quite a different picture that we're seeing on the screen of what might be involved by Crohn's disease.
Yes.
What are the commonest places that Crohn's disease could afflict the gut?
The commonest place for Crohn's disease is actually the very last part of the small intestine called the terminal ileum. That and the very last part of the colon called the cecum are the two most common areas where you might see Crohn's disease.
So right around where the appendix is, isn't
it? Correct.
Yeah. Now, colonoscopy is an important tool for diagnosis, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And I think we have a graphic of what a colonoscopy actually looks like, because you do a lot of these, and we've got nice normal mucosa here. It's smooth, it's shiny, there's not many blood vessels visible there. They're just under the surface, and all that looks very nice and normal.
Yes, this is what I'd like to see.
What do we see here?
Well, here we see a colon is very inflamed and irritated. You can see a lot of bleeding. It's very what we call friable, which means any contact with the lining will cause it to bleed. There's ulcerations, breaks in the lining. There's loss of the normal blood vessels. And there's also what we call exudates, which is inflammation, inflammatory cells that are leaking from the lining of the colon.
Are those the little yellow patches that we're
Yes.
just running by there, the exudates? And what would you want to do here? You'd want to take a biopsy, presumably.
Basically here, you want to make sure of what you're dealing with, and a biopsy is the best way to do that.
And so when you take a small biopsy, that tissue is then sent to the lab, and how do they make the diagnosis between the two diseases?
Well, basically, they have to have clinical information. There are certain features under the microscope that are very typical of Crohn's disease versus ulcerative colitis. So sometimes these features will help the pathologist tell the difference. But often, it's really incumbent upon the diagnosing physician to be able to tell the pathologist where is the disease located, what does it look like.
So you almost make the diagnosis at endoscopy.
Correct.
And get confirmation
Correct. Yes.
of the biopsy.
Yes.
And treatment, is it effective? We've just seen the story of Blair. She sounded like she was very sick, but she's looking pretty good there.
Yes, I mean, there are many treatments, and in fact, many more treatments in the last 20 years than there were before then. So I think the prognosis for most patients with these diseases is very good, and most of them will live a normal life.
Mm. Well, we still have lots to cover with Dr. Genovese, but we have to take a quick break, and when we come back, get ready to make some pesto and pasta. Don't miss it, but first, let's take a look at today's doctor's orders.
Hey, why didn't you join me and sing with me?
Well, I was waiting for you to hit the right note, but you didn't.
Yeah, well, I know I'm pretty bad. You know, even though I don't have perfect pitch, I really do enjoy playing the guitar and singing.
You shouldn't worry about the perfect pitch. You know, music is about expressing yourself and enjoyment. Do you know it's linked to cognitive improvement? And for little ones, they improve their language development, and it's good for social interaction.
You know, in parts of the brain, the two halves function separately. The left brain is analytical and the right brain is artistic. Performing or listening to music impacts both the brain as a whole. Therefore, it stimulates both halves.
Yeah, and I guess maybe Einstein's mother knew that, because when she was told that Albert was not very bright, she enrolled him in violin lessons, and pretty soon she had a genius on her hands. And you know, it just a really beautiful example of how a child's intellectual capacity can be opened up by music.
So is all music good for you?
Well, that's a whole different topic, but let's just say for now that the music that you're playing and singing is good for you.
You know, even though I'm out of tune, do you mind if I go ahead and play and sing?
I think you should. Doctor's orders.
Thank you, Doc.
I pray for the people that are sick so they can get better.
All around the world, children are praying at 7 in the morning, 7 in the evening, and 7 days a week.
I pray for everybody in Haiti that does not have a home.
Join the movement in your family today. 777 Prayer Kids.
Welcome back. Today we have Justin in the kitchen. Justin, tell us about today's recipe.
Today we are making, I kid you not, one of my absolute favorite recipes. I make this all the time,
oh,
and
really?
I just love it.
Oh, great.
We're making fresh pesto from scratch.
Mm-mm.
Basil pesto.
Yum.
Yum is right.
Yum.
Let me tell you what's in this stuff.
Please do.
2 cups of fresh basil leaves, 2 garlic cloves, 2 ounces of pine nuts, half a cup of olive oil, and salt to taste. And then, get this, instead of pasta, we are going to use fresh zucchini.
Mm-hmm.
It tastes just like pasta.
Really? Yeah. Especially when it's got pesto all over
exactly.
it, right?
Exactly. It's incredible.
So how do we make this?
This is one of the most easy... work to flavor ratio is really good.
Okay.
So it's super easy and it tastes delicious.
Great.
So it's just, you just dump it in. Okay. So I'm going to put all this basil in there. I love basil.
Do you grow basil at your house?
You know, I have grown basil at my house. I don't have a crop right now, but just you wait.
Yeah.
Put these pine nuts in there. Pine nuts are so good.
Did you know one of the varieties of basil is called Genovese basil?
I did not know
that.
Are we using Genovese right now?
No, we have Dr. Genovese in the studio with us right now. Yes.
Well, it'll be especially flavorful.
He knew that.
Okay, so we've got some olive oil here, which is, I mean, it's a fat, but it's good.
It's got monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fat, so it's a good fat to
it's
use.
It's not like Crisco or...
No. And you know, we could also use an omega-3 fat. We could use flaxseed oil for this too.
Yeah, that's true.
So, yeah, there's some options there.
Just put in some salt, and we're ready to go.
Okay, let's get cooking.
Yes! Now, I know you can smell that here, and I'm pretty sure you folks can smell it at home.
It's great.
It is.
Now, you may be wondering how to make the zucchini pasta. You just take, well, for me, it's a vegetable peeler and a zucchini. Or you can use a spiraler, and you literally just peel pieces off.
There's
and
the
then
pasta.
You can cut them, or you can leave them broad. But that's all we do, just like that.
So simple, and it tastes so good.
So, let's pour it on.
Just pour it up here. I'm looking forward to the part where we put it in our mouths.
Yum, yum.
That part is my favorite part of cooking.
That's great.
Yes.
Are we ready?
I'm ready.
Ready, aim, fire.
Yeah. So good.
That is very good.
I'm just going to take this with me.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, may I?
Oh, if you must.
Okay. I'll just hold on to this.
While Justin runs away with the dinner, let's take a look. Oh, but before we continue the interview with Dr. Genovese of basil fame,
yes.
Let's watch Shane Corson, a retired professional hockey player, tell his story of ulcerative colitis.
I was 15 years old. I was diagnosed at 15. I was playing minor hockey in Barrie, Ontario, living in Barrie with my parents and my two sisters. And I can remember the first symptoms were I was getting bad cramps in my stomach and getting cold and sweaty. And then I started realizing when I was eating, after I would eat or drink anything at all, I'd have to run to the toilet. And the trips to the toilet became quite more frequent. And eventually got to the point that everything was runny. And then it ended up being nothing but liquid and blood. And that's when I knew that there was something wrong. I didn't know what to do. Sometimes you think it's just going to go away, but that's not what happens. So I hit it, and my mom started noticing that I was, my energy level wasn't the same. I wasn't just the same person. I was losing weight. And then one night I was going through an episode. I was in the washroom, actually laying on the ground in the bathroom. In pain with the stomach cramps, and I've been on the toilet most of the night. She walked in and said, what's going on? She took a look in the toilet and realized there was a lot of blood in the toilet, and she knew at that point there was a serious problem. So obviously she set up doctor's appointments right away. He suggested we get a colonoscopy as soon as possible. I did that, and about a month later we got the results back, and I had ulcerative colitis. I love playing hockey, and my goal, like any other Canadian kid out of Barrie, Ontario, that I wanted to play in the NHL one day. And people started saying, you have colitis, you're not going to make it. It's a disease that will keep you from doing the things you want to do. And I thought in my mind, there's no way. That was my dream, lifelong dream, was to play in the NHL, and I was going to make it, and I wasn't going to let that affect me. There was some times where there was ups and downs. I missed the odd practice, missed games because of it. When I first realized I was having certain symptoms, I hid it for 3 or 4 months. Instead of getting in there and getting it checked out and finding out what you have, and then you can deal with what you have. If you don't know what you have, how do you deal with it? How do you get better? You can't. You have to go in, get early diagnosed, then find out the right treatment, management plan for yourself. And everybody's different. There's different variations of the disease. And you have to find out what's best for you.
That's right, and everybody is different. Tell us, what are the risk factors for inflammatory bowel disease?
Well, basically, one of the risk factors is genetic. We think that certain families tend towards inflammatory bowel disease. In general, this is a disease of younger people, of young adults and children. There may be other factors that trigger this disease. Certain types of infections may trigger the beginning of ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease.
Are there other organs affected, or only the bowel?
Because these diseases are diseases of the immune system, there are a lot of other organs affected. The eyes and the joints are the main ones that come to mind. The skin can be affected, and sometimes the liver can be affected.
And what are the complications of the disease? And I know we're really talking about two different diseases, but what are the complications of, say, ulcerative colitis or Crohn's?
Well, the main complications revolve around nutrition, honestly, because with these diseases, the disease itself uses up a lot of calories. Also, patients are not able to eat properly, so malnutrition is very common, weight loss, these sorts of complications. Anemia is very common because bleeding is often a part of both diseases.
Yeah, we just heard Shane sharing how much blood loss he had before he was diagnosed.
Exactly. And again, also just pain and disability.
So I understand that the risk of colorectal cancer is increased in this group of people. Which ones would have that increased risk?
Well, the risk is related to two things. One is the extent of disease, how much of the colon is involved with either Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. The second factor is how long has the patient had it. The longer you've had these diseases, the more the risk of cancer increases. There may be some factor of how well it's treated. In other words, patients who are not treated properly, their cancer risk may be higher as opposed to patients where the disease has been controlled as well as possible with medical therapy.
So sticking with the therapy is important for your long-term risk.
Absolutely, absolutely.
What actually causes the disease? What's at the basis of inflammatory bowel disease?
Basically, it's a series of immune system triggers where the immune system reacts as if there were an infection. It starts releasing chemicals and substances into the intestinal tract that actually, instead of fighting any infection, actually cause damage to the lining of the intestinal tract, can cause the surface of the intestinal tract to be eroded away, can cause narrowing and scarring, also can cause areas where the bowel may develop what's called a fistula, which is where one area of the bowel actually leaks into another area.
And that would require surgery?
Most cases, yes.
Most cases. All right. So tell us about first the medications. There must be a number of medications available. How do you make that choice?
Well, basically, there are a number of medications. The simplest medications tend to be what we call topical. They act right where the inflammation is. They tend to be pills or enema-type therapy where the medicine is delivered directly to where the disease is without really having to go through the bloodstream. Those are the simplest treatments. Other treatments generally will affect the immune system in some way, normally inhibiting it, as we heard in the one video clip.
So things like steroids?
Yes.
But you can't stay on steroids long term, can you?
Correct. So many other agents, which are called steroid-sparing agents, and also are called immune modulators, these medications can be used more long term. They don't seem to have as many of the side effects as prednisone or steroids, but may have problems of their own in terms of cancer risks.
How long would a typical IBD patient need to be on those kinds of medications, the immunomodulators?
Basically, once they're required, most of those patients are on a low dose of them continually and permanently. The idea being to keep the disease in remission, keep the immune system from flaring once again.
Mm. And is it the bacteria in the gut that normally lives in the gut that causes the problem, or?
There is some thought that the bacteria may actually be a trigger. If certain proteins in the bacteria are exposed to the lining of the colon or get into the immune system, they actually can trigger this immune response. So bacteria and the population of bacteria in the gut do seem to be an important role.
Mm. What about antibiotics? Do they have a role in the disease?
Antibiotics are generally used for infectious complications, but there is some evidence that these antibiotics actually, in a patient who's flaring, may help settle down the inflammation, settle down the flare of the disease.
Mm. Is that because they take out some of those normal bacteria that live there, or do
it's
we
not
know?
Well understood, to be honest. It's not well understood exactly why they work. We know that bacteria do play a role in the immune system function, so removing them from the picture must be the reason that it helps improve things.
Mm. This is all great information. We'll continue this discussion right after the break, and when we come back, we'll have some practical demonstrations for you. But first, take a look at today's medical news report. In the headlines today, L-carnitine, meat and heart disease, environmental risks for IBD, and beets beat hypertension. Meat eaters have bacteria in their gut that metabolizes a meat byproduct called L-carnitine into a substance linked to hardening of the arteries. By eating a diet high in carnitine, the growth of the bacteria is increased. This compounds the effect. Now research has found that high levels of carnitine are associated with increased risk for heart disease, heart attacks, and stroke. Vegetarian and vegan participants in the Cleveland Clinic study had significantly lower risk of disease. A review of inflammatory bowel disease published in this month's journal Gut suggests that environmental factors play a major role in altering the risk of inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD. Westernization of lifestyle and industrialization are both associated with increased rates. Geographic location also plays a role. The strongest association? Cigarette smoking and appendectomy. So, to prevent IBD, simplify your lifestyle, adopt a good diet, and don't smoke. Drinking a cup of nitrate-rich beetroot juice significantly lowers blood pressure in cases of hypertension. Fruits and vegetables, especially beetroot and leafy veggies, contain inorganic nitrate. When that's converted to nitric oxide, the blood vessels dilate. Researchers in London found that within 3 to 6 hours of drinking a cup of beetroot juice, both systolic and diastolic blood pressure dropped 10 points. 24 hours later, they were still 8 points lower than control. So as Hippocrates said, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's medical news report.
Shout for joy to the Lord, all the earth. Worship the Lord with gladness. Come before Him with joyful songs. Know that the Lord is God. It is He who made us, and we are His. We are His people, the sheep of His pasture. Enter His gates with thanksgiving and His courts with praise. Give thanks to Him and praise His name. For the Lord is good and His love endures forever. His faithfulness continues through all generations.
Welcome back. Joining us now is naturopath Dr. Jim Sharps. Welcome, Dr. Sharps.
Thank you.
Now, what is that? What have you brought with you?
This is slurry charcoal. This is one of the most powerful natural remedies known to man. It's you take charcoal, you mix it in, and you let the chunks go to the bottom, mm-hmm. and then you have this immersion. And this is basically what you use. Now, charcoal can be used for both external and external wounds.
So you use it with inflammatory bowel disease.
Absolutely.
How do you use that? Because I see there's a fine suspension of,
that's right,
of charcoal there.
Right. That fine suspension. What charcoal does, it absorbs 80 times its weight in poison. So for when you have irritable bowel syndrome, or you have Crohn's, or ulcerative colitis. You have this inflammation, you have diarrhea, you have blood, and what this does, it goes in there and it absorbs a lot of those poisons. It's also because of the compromised functional integrity of the gastrointestinal system, you're not absorbing food. So there's putrefaction going on, there's fermentation, there's a whole host of issues going on. What this does is it's like a natural vacuum cleaner. It goes in and it attaches, adsorbs that poisons and pulls it out. It dries up the diarrhea. So you don't want to use it if you have the constipation part of IBS. But if you have the other loose stools and things of that nature, it's a very powerful, natural, relatively inexpensive remedy. Mm. And you just sip it. You sip it as is. You don't pull the powder from the bottle.
Okay, so you're just sipping the clear, what's clarified.
That's correct.
Now let's take a look at this practical demonstration. Joining me now is Daniel McKibben, hydrotherapist and massage therapist, and we're going to do some hydrotherapy or water treatment now. Daniel, what treatment are we doing today?
We're going to do hot and cold fomentations.
That sounds like what you do with grapes to get wine. Fermentation.
No, that's the wrong word. It's fomentation, not fermentation.
All right. I'm glad you cleared that up. Otherwise, our friend Hannah, who's our patient today, would be fermenting on the table. And today we're going to pretend that Hannah has a sore tummy, but what might we use hot and cold fomentations for?
Hot and cold has a whole slew of uses. You can use it for colds and flus and, like you said, pain or any digestive problems, arthritis. Can clear up infections, like skin infections, that type of thing. Just a whole bunch of things.
I can think I've used it for pneumonia, broken ribs, the pain of broken ribs, serious abdominal pain. What have you used it for?
Oh, I've used it for the same things you're talking about, mostly colds and flus, though.
And bronchitis and those kinds of things. Yes. All right, what do we do to start?
Well, what we do is we bare her skin, and we're going to put a dry towel on top of that, about 4 to 6 layers. Mm-hmm. And then we have a towel in the microwave that we have wet down and put in a plastic bag and heated it up for 5 minutes on high.
So just a normal shopping bag like this and a wet towel. And now I think you're going to need these, aren't you?
I know.
And we'll get this hot, hot towel out of here.
And you'll see maybe the steam coming out here because it's very, very hot. And because we have the layers of towel on Hannah, she will not get burned. And we just put that right over her abdomen like that. And then we put several layers of dry towel on top of that so that we hold that steam in and that heat.
Right, because as the water has boiled and turned to steam, that's where the energy is and that's where the heat really is.
That's exactly right.
Now, how important is it that we keep the skin dry?
It's very important because the water transmits the heat and we could burn her. And by the way, Hannah, how's that doing? Is the heat coming through yet?
It feels very comfortable and yes, they can.
Good. Now you please tell us if it gets too hot. We do not want to burn you, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So right now we've got the towel wrapped. We've got 6 layers in there. And if we needed to put some extra layers in, we could just scoot these under maybe.
That's right. And if it gets too cool, we remove some of the layers. If it gets too hot, we add layers. So you just do it that way.
And how long do we leave that hot fomentation on her tummy?
For 5 minutes.
5 minutes. Now, let's pretend our 5 minutes is up. What do we do now?
Okay, now we take our ice cold water, and this is serious water that's been in ice. And I wring this thing out, and then I'm so sorry, Hannah. I am going to shock you with some ice cold water. We remove all the toweling, and then we do a cold friction there. Very cold on the abdomen.
She's so brave.
She is. How's that feel?
Very, very cold.
Okay, then we take that off. We did it for about 10 or 15 seconds, dry it off, and then put our layers of towel back down, maybe 4 to 5 to 6 layers. And then we have a new towel that we've been heating up in the microwave. And we put
And then we go through the same process. Exactly. So how many changes will we do?
We do a minimum of 3 changes, and you can go up to 6 or 9 or, you know, just several changes, but 3 is the minimum.
Minimum of 3, and if it's a serious problem, you might think about going up to 4 or 5, and if you have time, maybe 6.
That's right.
So this can be really helpful in dealing with pain and infection and these kinds of things. Now, are there times when we would never want to use this?
You never want to use it on a diabetic or somebody who doesn't have feeling or atherosclerosis, that type of thing.
And appendix. If you think somebody might have appendicitis, never use this treatment.
Exactly.
And they need to have full feeling, so not, you know, someone who has a stroke and who's lost some, got some numbness, again, because the risk of burning is there, you need to be very safe. And so that's great. How is it feeling, Hannah?
Very comfortable.
Very comfortable. Good.
And so we always finish on cold on all of our hydrotherapy treatments. So let's say that we've done hot, cold, hot, cold, hot, cold with Hannah. And so now we can just finish on the cold, dry her off.
What do we need to do once we've dried off and we're finished and she's got dressed and she's lying there? What now?
Well, the most important thing is rest. And so she needs to either sleep or just lay down for 45 minutes to an hour. And that's very important.
All right. So resting allows the body to really focus on healing that area. And if you go get active, then the circulation and the process that was happening, you disrupt it. So it's much better to make the most of it and allow this to basically be a one-hour treatment, because you've done the treatment for about 15 to 20 minutes, then you rest for 45. So it does take a little time, and that's one of the things about more natural therapies is they take time. You can't just throw the pill down.
They take time on the immediate, but in the long term, they save you time because they're so effective that they cure you oftentimes after just 1 or 2 treatments, not all the time.
Yeah. Right, and I typically would invest 3 days of treatment with something like this.
That's right, that's right.
Well, thank you, Hannah,
You're welcome.
Giving us your tummy. You've been a great tummy today.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Daniel.
You're very welcome.
You've texted, you've called, and you've posted on Facebook. Thank you so much. Now it's time to answer your questions. Jubilant posted on Facebook, Dr. Narada, thank you for being such a good host and doctor on the program. I'm blessed each time I watch. Thanks, Jubilant. That's really kind. There's a text message that says, can you help me? I am 42. I've never got pregnant. I went to many doctors. They say nothing is wrong with me or with my husband. I'm really sorry to hear that. Infertility does occur to 10 to 15% of couples, and 1 in 10 of those have no obvious cause for their infertility. We call it unexplained infertility. In other words, both husband and wife have all the tests and everything checks out normal. Typically, treatment is provided at that point. A fertility clinic might start with the least invasive and work and the least costly, and then work up to the most invasive and costly, which would be in vitro fertilization. So there is still treatment, even though we don't know what's causing the infertility. Another caller asked, what is the best milk and cereal to have for breakfast for someone who has diabetes? That is such an important question. You know, I would encourage you to try cooking grains in a pot or a crock pot rather than having dry cereal. And that will give you less fat, less sugar, less processing of your food. And the reason that that's so important is it gives less of a surge in your postprandial blood glucose or your after-meal glucose levels. Be sure you have a couple of fresh fruit with that and a small handful of nuts, because the fresh fruit has not been shown to make the diabetes control worse, and we know there are so many good nutrients in the fruit. The nuts give you some nice monounsaturated fats, which are important for heart health, and diabetes really does hammer the heart. For milk, if I were you, I would probably choose a nut, a grain, or a soy milk, so that there's no cholesterol and limited amounts of saturated fats. Now, there's another question. Would you please advise me how to reduce triglyceride levels from 165 down to normal? Triglycerides are the big word for fats in the blood, and they can impact heart health. So ideally, we want to get them down to less than 100, well, 100 or less. So start with weight loss. Limit your sugar. Often people drink sodas or drink sugar. So eliminate that. That's an easy way to get some of the sugar out of your diet. Limit your saturated fats, your trans fats, which are most commonly found in margarines, saturated fats in animal products. Increase your omega-3s. It's surprising. You would think adding fat to your diet would increase the fats in your blood, but in fact, some people, when they have omega-3s, it drops their triglycerides. So try adding the omega-3 fats like flaxseed oil. Eliminate alcohol and increase physical activity. Once you have all of those things in place, which is not overnight, by the way, that's going to take some time, but if your triglycerides are still high at that point, then your doctor may want to put you on medication. Thanks for sending those questions. They were great. Call us now with your question about inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis or Crohn's. Our guest experts are right here waiting for your questions. The number is 855-400-HEALTHY. And remember, you can also text us or post those questions on our Facebook page. Now, in a moment, we'll continue our discussion on inflammatory bowel disease. But first, take a look at this Bon Appetit. How many carrots have you eaten in your lifetime? Countless, I'm sure. In fact, many of us were weaned on cooked, mashed carrots. Originally, carrots were eaten for their leaves and their seeds. Nowadays, though, we just eat the taproot and we tend to throw the leaves away. However, dill, fennel, cumin are aromatic relatives of the carrot. Carrots are a summer crop and can be companion plants. It's said that if they're intercrop with tomatoes, that you get a better yield from your tomatoes. And if you leave them to flower, well, they attract predatory wasps, which can deal with your garden pests. In the humble carrot are several compounds. Polyacetylenes are compounds that can kill cells. So some people use carrot juice as part of their fight against cancer. There also have antifungal compounds in them, which can give them a bitter taste. Steaming and stir frying are great ways to eat carrots, and many people use baby carrots as part of their weight loss snacking regime. A baby carrot has only 5 calories. Bon appetit. Dr. Genovese, what might trigger, you were talking about a flare in the illness, what might trigger a flare?
Commonly, it can be an infection of some other system. Sometimes it can be dietary, eating a food that disagrees with the GI tract. Sometimes it can be stress. In other words, stressful events sometimes will trigger the immune system. So those three things are the main things I think about.
Right. So if we think about food, can an elimination diet be helpful?
It seems that elimination diets, particularly in children, can be very effective. They're very difficult to do, but they can be effective and are definitely something to consider.
And so what a parent might do is take a number of things that they suspect might be triggers out of the diet, keep them out. How long do you recommend that they keep them out for if they're experimenting?
If they're experimenting, I'd say for at least 2 weeks, you know, at minimum, to really know. And I think it may take longer to be sure.
And then they just introduce them one at a time.
Exactly. Often it can be done with the aid of a nutritionist. That's often a resource.
So do you refer many of your IBD patients to a nutritionist?
Ones that struggle with their diet, yes, I do.
Right, and that can be really helpful. Mm-hmm. Great. Now, what dietary advice do you give as a naturopath, Dr. Sharps, for your inflammatory bowel disease patients?
Yes, it just so happens I emphasize corrective nutrition. And nutrition, proper diet, is extremely effective for a whole host of gastrointestinal issues. Mm-hmm. And what I recommend for people that have IBS or Crohn's is a mono diet. Very simple diet, a minimum of 2 weeks, as Dr. Genovese said. But I actually have them be on it for like 3 to 6 weeks. And we do a kind of a graduated diet. What I would do is actually start them with just a juice diet. You do that for 2 to 3 days. Really rest the gastrointestinal system. The problem is you keep eating and eating and eating, and you don't give your gastrointestinal system an opportunity to rest.
Rest and heal.
And so juice, nobody's allergic to juice. A lot of them are allergies to foods, primarily lactose intolerance, gluten intolerance, a combination of those. Pizza, you have both. It's like a hand grenade and and another kind of a bomb, an IED thrown at your gastrointestinal system. So you start with a mono diet. You start with juicing for a few days.
What would you juice?
I would use something like pineapple because it has bromelain in there, very healing. Pineapple, apple, lemon is really good. And you can throw a little bit of ginger in there, which is very healing for the gastrointestinal system. Throw a little celery in there. So something like that, something very mild. You can even put a little bit of spinach in there or kale. And it's very tasty. It's very nourishing. And then you start with something like apples, which are very easy. And then you start graduating up to steamed vegetables. Potatoes are particularly good. Yams, cabbage with the vitamin U, which is very healing to the gastrointestinal system. So diet is very, very important. I would eliminate those food allergy foods for 3 to 6 weeks at least. And depending upon what the situation is, it could be longer. Another thing that may be helpful is a certain herbal things like aloe vera, which is very healing. Ginger that I mentioned. Peppermint is very healing. Slippery elm is a carminative. If you have spasms going on, lobelia. So there are herbs that you can use on a transition basis. So with proper diet, a mono diet, a simple diet, and managing that over a period of time, you can actually completely reverse over 90% of those kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm. And the herbs, do you put them as a tea? Do you put them into the juice? What do you do with those?
Primarily as a tea.
And the aloe, what? How do you do the aloe?
You can take a couple of ounces a day, a couple of ounces 2 to 3 times a day. So you want a little bit of that. Mm. And it depends. You know, you have to kind of personalize it. Sometimes aloe vera can be actually caustic. So you have to see what situation is going on. Is there diarrhea? Is there constipation? So you use the herbs and you use the diet based on the particular phase that they're in. As Dr. Genovese indicated, Crohn's, you got to be a little bit more careful. They're going through multiple layers of the gastrointestinal system, whereas IBS is just the first two layers. Mm-hmm. You can take a little bit more liberty. Mm-hmm. But it has to be very individualized. You want to completely avoid things that you know are problems like caffeine, alcohol. And when I say caffeine, it's not just coffee, it's soda. It's even the first cousin, chocolate, with the
right.
Theobromine and theophylline, which are very, very caustic to the gastrointestinal system.
Now, Dr. Genovese, you mentioned nutritional deficiencies being a problem. Osteoporosis is one thing that these patients do struggle with, isn't it?
Yes, it is, because they may not absorb calcium or vitamin D well. Also, patients on steroids or prednisone, they also tend to waste bone as well. So
how do we overcome that risk with IBD patients?
Well, I think over the past 20 years, on the medical side of things, we've tried to steer away from prednisone and steroids a little more than we used to. We use them less, try to keep patients on them for a shorter period of time. And then the second part is really just trying to manage the nutritional deficiencies by supplementing.
Mm. So you supplement vitamin D and calcium for
Yes. Most
of these patients.
Mm-hmm.
How much do you give?
Basically, I still use the recommended amounts that we use for patients with osteoporosis. So sort of along the lines of those dosages, mm-hmm. You know, usually about 1,200 milligrams or so of calcium with vitamin D. I believe it's 800 units.
Units a day.
Yeah.
Mm. All right. Now, I was going to inquire a little bit more. You were saying about the caffeine. Why does caffeine have such an effect on the intestine? Caffeine, alcohol, nicotine, why do they impact the bowel so much?
They're poisons, and they cause a violent reaction, peristaltic action, in the gastrointestinal system. And they just wreak havoc. As I said, it's the caffeine, alcohol, sodas with caffeine in it, chocolate. All of those things are very toxic, and the gastrointestinal is very reactive to it, and reactive in a very negative way.
And I guess also with nicotine,
yes,
you're shrinking down the blood vessels as
right.
well, and so the blood supply,
mm-hmm.
while you've got bleeding in the gut, I guess you don't really want to reduce the blood supply.
That's right.
You
have the vasoconstriction plus the thousands of chemicals in there that the gastrointestinal system has to negotiate.
Now, Dr. Genovese, sometimes surgery is required, and I guess the longer you have inflammatory bowel disease, the higher the risk of surgery. But what particularly is surgery needed for?
The most common reason for surgery is blockages. In other words, the disease, after a time, can cause narrowing and scarring of the intestine, so much so that it blocks. And if there's a blockage, that is something that needs to be taken care of fairly immediately. The other reason is patients that may have problems with a lot of bleeding, you know, that's not being controlled. Some of those patients may end up with surgery. The third place is where patients are very, very acutely ill with colitis. Sometimes patients present with very severe, what they call surgical abdomen, meaning that the integrity of the lining of the gut is completely gone, and you're risking a complete body infection if you don't do something. In that situation, surgery is sometimes done.
And I think for ulcerative colitis patients, you can affect cure by giving them an ileostomy.
That's true.
That's pretty major.
That's pretty major, yes.
But a cure can be something worth thinking about. Well, we still have lots to cover with both of our experts, and they're ready to take your questions. So after a short break, we'll get there. But first, let's enjoy another Ageless Advantage.
Colorectal cancer, a leading cause of death in the U.S., usually begins with a growth of benign polyps. The good news is that polyps can be avoided with a high-fiber diet. The Adventist Health Study found that eating legumes at least 3 times a week, or brown rice once a week, reduced the risk of colon polyps by about 40%. Whole grains and legumes, such as garbanzos, beans, and lentils, are an excellent source of fiber. A high-fiber diet is another Ageless Advantage.
When temptations assail you, when care, perplexity, and darkness seem to surround your soul, look to the place where you last saw the light. Rest in Christ's love and under His protecting care. When sin struggles for the mastery in the heart, when guilt oppresses the soul and burdens the conscience, when unbelief clouds the mind, remember that Christ's grace is sufficient to subdue sin and banish the darkness. Entering into communion with the Savior, we enter the region of peace.
The things we do for Cross Connection.
We'll crawl through the tiny hole and then complete darkness.
I already saw a couple of snakes on the way in. And what could there possibly be in there that'll help us with our study?
Welcome back. Our experts are ready to take your questions on inflammatory bowel disease. So call us now, 855-400-HEALTHY. And while you call us, let's take a look at more of Shane's story.
My doctor talked to me about how ulcerative colitis affects the lining of the bowel, and now new research shows that healing the lining of the bowel may not only help to control symptoms, but may even help people live a more normal life and also reduce the need for surgery.
The key things I had was a great, great doctors, and obviously my family were the main things I had for support, and they helped me manage it. But I really believe in my heart, me being positive, when I found out I had it, I wasn't going to let it hold me down. I wasn't going to let it stop me from doing anything I wanted to do. I was going to barrel through it, climb the mountain, and move on to the next challenge. But there was a lot of impact for me, but I learned to deal with it, and I look back now and there's stories for me. I find them funny, to be honest with you. You know, it's just part of me. Ulcerative colitis is part of my life. I've been through some embarrassing moments. I say embarrassing meaning back then I thought they were embarrassing. Now they're part of my life. Working out, for me, it relieves a lot of stress. You know, everybody's different. You know, we just go for a walk, you know, learn how to do proper breathing, different things that I've done that have helped me. I think it's important to do the things you love to do, and don't let ulcerative colitis stop you from doing those, because it's just a vicious cycle. So stay on top of it. Now I'm on my maintenance program and I have no signs whatsoever still. I feel, health-wise, I feel great. When I found out I had colitis, there were certain things I couldn't eat or drink, and that was dairy products. So my mom knew right away I needed calcium, so she put a program together with vitamins to help me with the nutrients, so I kept myself strong and energetic, and those types of things helped, for sure. For me, the best advice is not to be embarrassed and shy about it, deal with it head on. But the biggest thing is to get it looked at right away.
Early detection on any disease, I believe, is a big part of it. I think that's the most important thing is to get in there, and if you're having symptoms, get in there and get it looked at. And once you get diagnosed, then you meet it head on. And you find the best management you can find for yourself, the best treatment. I'm not saying the disease is easy in any way. It's a tough disease, and it's frustrating at times. But I mean, you got to stay on it and don't give up.
Love it. Don't give up. Now, Dr. Sharps.
Yes.
Shane is a great example. You know, this disease can really give people fatigue.
Yes.
How important is it to stay active, to be physically active and get that exercise in?
Well, it's absolutely important. The exercise helps you to release the toxins. It's the only way you engage the lymphatic system to get those poisons out of the system. So the exercise is a very important component of the healing process, along with the dietary factors.
So how do you balance the fatigue and the activity? How much would you say people should be doing?
Well, you don't want to over-exercise. And a lot of the fatigue is brought about by the blood loss. And so you want to take care of that issue. And one of the things that I work with world-class athletes. And you know, with the competition and everything, they're stressed out. They have the nervous stomach, and they're eating the donuts and all of that. So you put them on a very good diet. And then to help with the blood loss, I have this concoction. It's a dry fruit. It's a natural blood transfusion. You take whatever container you have, a glass container. You put 1/3 raisins, dates, figs, all those dried fruits. The rest of it distilled water. You let it sit for 24 hours, and then that brown water. You don't need the fruit anymore. You refrigerate it. You take 4 ounces a day. It's a natural blood transfusion. It's loaded with bioavailable iron. And you know, sometimes you might have to supplement with some vitamins and minerals, but you can do it with diet alone. See, what I focus on is what's causing and contributing to the factor, and that's where the individual...
So you're treating the fatigue, that's what you're saying?
That's correct. Well, if you're gluten intolerant and you're eating bread and pasta, you stop the bread and pasta, then you have the energy back again.
Now, Dr. Genovese, we mentioned how the bacteria in the gut could contribute to this problem. Do probiotics help?
We think that they do. I think the problem right now is there are very many different types of probiotics out there. We really don't know which patient, which probiotic, for how long. Those are the unanswered questions right now.
Right, so which particular friendly bacteria? And then the potency and the purity can vary in different preparations. And I'd love to know the final answer, what's good and what's not. What do you recommend, Jim?
I always use probiotics.
A particular variety or not?
I work with, Dr. Genovese is right, you can't get over-the-counter type of products. You want to work with a reputable company. There's a whole lot out there.
Yeah.
I work with various labs, but probiotics, digestive enzymes also help.
Okay. Now, we have a caller on the line, Ed from New Hampshire. Ed, welcome to Go Healthy. What's your question for my experts?
Once you have pockets in your intestines, are they reversible or are you just stuck with them?
Okay. I'm going to give this one to Dr. Genovese. Pockets in the intestine. I know this is not inflammatory bowel disease. So we're talking, presumably, about diverticulosis.
Exactly. I think you are talking about diverticulosis. Diverticulosis by itself is not reversible, but there can be measures you take dietary-wise to help prevent them from progressing and to helpfully prevent them from causing trouble for you.
So one piece of dietary advice.
High fiber.
Okay. Thank you. Now, we mentioned stress, and Shane uses exercise to manage stress. Mm-hmm. Dr. Sharps, how important is stress for inflammatory bowel disease?
It's extremely important.
Or stress management, I should say.
That's what I meant, the stress management, managing the stress. You shouldn't eat when you're under stress. Stress shuts down the gastrointestinal system. That's basically what it does, the fight flight. So the blood goes completely away from the stomach. You don't have any digestive juices going through. So the food just sits there, ferments, putrefies. That's where you get those secondary issues of the bacteria, parasites, and all those other issues, which are, as you know, very problematic. And then you need something to get rid of those viruses, bacteria, et cetera. As a naturopath, we use more natural types of antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Genovese, how important is a good sleep schedule?
I think it's important. We talked about fatigue and the importance of exercise, but really, particularly if you're going to exercise, you need to allow your body time to recover. And that's why sleep and rest and a regular sleep cycle, regular eating cycle, regular exercise cycle are very important.
Mm. And so as you exercise, you're going to be able to sleep better. As you manage stress, you're going to be able to sleep better. And as you sleep better, your illness is going to improve. So it's all part of the same process.
All tied together.
All tied together. And tell me, Jim, what you were going to say about stress. Give us a tip for managing stress, because I know this is really important.
Well, exercise, deep breathing, those are two major ones, relaxation techniques, classical music. There's a whole host of things. Again, it's individualized. That's why it's very important to understand the dietary and lifestyle factors that the particular person is going through. And it really jumps out at you. And the individual, you can't, it's not one blanket thing.
All right, now I have a text message here. Mm-hmm. I often get sores in my mouth, especially when I have, when my IBD is active. Are these related and what can I do about them?
They are related. And basically, there are sort of topical treatments that can be used, but I think control of the disease is going to be the most important thing.
So control the basic disease. Well, thank you, gentlemen. It's been wonderful having you on the show. Thanks for coming back. Now, if you have a family history of inflammatory bowel disease, don't turn those genes on. Avoid antibiotics when you can. Don't smoke. Eat a healthy, high-fiber diet with no or low meat intake. And if you already have the disease, eat well, sleep well, avoid smoking, and instead of drinking caffeine, alcohol, or sodas, drink plenty of water and juice those veggies. Experiment with your diet to find out what might be triggering those flare-ups. Find a good gastroenterologist, and if you're on medication, take it regularly. I want to thank you for joining us on Go Healthy for Good, and we'll see you next time.